their new album, which is called Bird's Nest, and this is Maybe Molly. And we may be having some special programming any minute now. It's supposed to have kicked in automatically, but I may have to kickstart it myself. I wonder if this will work. Anyway, thanks for listening to the Saturday Edge this week, and if this doesn't work, I'll be with you for another 2 hours. Wish me luck. I don't know how this would work, actually. Seat of the Pants Radio here at CITR, as usual.
As a station, we believe in playing content with artistic and cultural merit, and sometimes that category includes material which can be construed as offensive. For those who have children nearby or are sensitive to provocative material, the following broadcast may have strong language, themes, or be otherwise objectionable. Please consider tuning out and revisiting CITR after this program.
On Saturday, December 10th, communities around the world recognized the culmination of 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. This begins with the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women on November 25th, and ends with Human Rights Day, which takes place today. From 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., CITR is broadcasting a selection of content that speaks to gendered violence, other forms of social violence, and possible modes of resistance. You can listen to these selections online by finding them under our special broadcast page at CITR.ca/radio/special-broadcast.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam,
Nisiaya, and the Sakhlia, Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustail. You are about to hear a selection of talks put on by Chinatown Action Group and the Alliance Against Displacement. The housing crisis is global, anti-imperialist perspectives on the foreign investor myth in BC, which took place on November 29th, 2016, at the Russian Hall. CITR 101.9 FM recognizes that housing is a human rights issue that intersects with class, ethnicity, and gender, and hopes that this discussion and breadth of perspectives can illuminate paths forward.
如果需要国语翻译，可以去那个翻译桌子，我朋友Nat会帮你。
So we just said if you need translation equipment, go see Nat for Cantonese and Mandarin. So my name is Janie Leung. My Chinese name is Leung Wing Si. I was born here and I grew up here on Coast Salish territories, and my ancestors are from the Guangdong province of China. I'm an organizer with the Chinatown Action Group, which is one of the groups putting on this event tonight. And we're an intergenerational group of Chinese who stand with and organize Chinese working class against displacement and exclusion. And we also aim to build their leadership and power to be at the forefront of the struggle, and we fight for the right of communities to remain where they live and to thrive in their communities. Do you want to talk about Alliance Against Displacement?
So I'm part of the Alliance Against Displacement. We've been trying to organize a pan-regional housing movement. We've done some work out in Burnaby, we've done some work out in Surrey, and we've done some work out in Maple Ridge. Well, from my context, I've been organizing the downtown east side for 5 years now.
And we were just going to frame the event a bit before we go into the panel speakers, but essentially, this event came out of two of our groups, Alliance Against Displacement and Chinatown Action Group, collaborating together to work on this forum because we felt it was really important to have an intervention on a lot of the discourse and a lot of the language that's been used lately around both the housing crisis and around foreign investment and the role of that in the housing crisis. So we find that a lot of the language being used is around middle class values and the right to home ownership and
For both of our organizations, we work with working class communities facing displacement, facing homelessness, and we want to put forward a more critical and alternative analysis of why there's a housing crisis and also why there's so much anti-Asian racism lately and why foreigners are being blamed for the housing crisis. And, you know, what we're seeing is when people talk about foreigners, it's not just people that don't live in Canada or who aren't from Canada, but they actually mean Asians specifically or the wealthy Chinese. And there's this idea that they're buying up all the property and that's the reason for the housing crisis. But it's been interesting that there actually hasn't been any evidence to show that. And the response is to call for more data, right? But that actually doesn't exist. So we felt it was really important to hold this forum. We're seeing escalating anti-Asian racism, and we feel like that's really distracting. It's been a really effective distraction against the root causes of the housing crisis. So I'm really excited to hear what the panel has to say. We kind of brought these people together around four themes that we think underlie the housing crisis and also the foreign investment myth. So I'll just introduce the four themes. The first is that BC is a settler province, and it was constructed through the dispossession of Indigenous peoples from their land. And second, that there's a long-standing history of anti-Asian racism, so this is nothing new. And this has a role in the creation of this foreign investment myth. And third, that we continue to see ongoing exploitation of migrant labor and racist Canadian immigration policies. And then finally, we want to talk about what the role of private property and global capital is in the current crisis. So we have a power panel talking about each of these themes, and we'll introduce the speakers.
I just wanted to add, too, it's highly ironic that this current housing crisis is being outright blamed on foreigners. It completely ignores how Canada was being set. It completely ignores the founding of Canada as a colonial construct. And I would argue that not only, Canada depends upon the continual displacement, the continual marginalization of Indigenous people, of all people of color, that this whole idea, from an Indigenous perspective, the whole idea of capital to us is really foreign. So to me, it really doesn't matter who's buying up all these houses, and not redistributing that wealth.
And next we have Beverly Ho, Yingyan. She's a Chinese settler artist and organizer born and raised on the West Coast with ancestral origins from Samsui, Guangdong, Shengzhou, and Gongso, right, in China. She's grateful to be working with and constantly learning from several groups in the neighborhood, including Chinatown Action Group, Alliance Against Displacement, Chinatown Concern Group, and Youth for Chinese Seniors. And next we have beside her Stephanie Feng, Feng Yip. She traces her family's migratory roots from Guangdong, where her grandparents lived until they fled Hong Kong during the Japanese occupation of China in World War II. Her parents later migrated to Turtle Island in the late 1980s. She lives, works, and creates as a visitor on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations, where she supports the struggles of marginalized communities in Chinatown and the Chinatown Action Group. She also works for the UBC Asian Canadian and Asian Migration Studies Program. And then we have Hesit Torres. She's a registered nurse from the Philippines who came to Canada in 2014 under the Live-In Caregiver Program. After experiencing the harsh realities of being a migrant worker and the exploitation and abuse it entails, she decided to assert her rights as a worker but was unjustly terminated by her employer. Through a family friend in Manila, she came to know of Migrante BC and the work it does in educating and empowering the Filipino community in asserting its rights for decent and just working conditions. She recognizes that migrant rights will be better protected when we come to understand that if we are good enough to work, we're good enough to stay. And Herb, were you going to introduce Ivan?
Good evening. Can you all hear me? Thank you to the MCs tonight, to Chinatown Action Group for co-organizing this forum with Alliance Against Displacement. And thank you to our audience members who are here to listen and participate in this conversation. I'm speaking tonight as an uninvited guest on occupied and unceded Coast Salish territories, land that has been stewarded and cared for by the Tsleil-Waututh, Squamish, and Musqueam peoples for such a long time that this land's occupation by imperialist and settler colonial forces seems like, by comparison, a very short, even if very effective, blip in history. My name is Natalie Knight, and I am Yurok from Northern California and Navajo from New Mexico. I am also a member of the Alliance Against Displacement and part of the editorial collective of the Volcano newspaper. My talk tonight hopes to build some material connections between the forces of settler colonialism as we experience them in BC today and the imperialist role of Canada in the context of the global economy. I have to say at the outset that my talk does not attempt to provide conclusions. The issue of foreign investment in housing in Canada and in BC specifically is very complicated, and it is my hope that through the combined efforts of our panelists tonight, we might open up some new perspectives on foreign investment that will work to undo the dominant racist, imperialist, and ahistorical commentary that we hear too often in the mainstream media. My talk tonight hinges on making some beginning connections between what we term settler colonialism in the context of BC and wider forms of capitalist imperialism that are related aspects of the global economy. Therefore, the first section of my talk focuses on settler colonialism. The second section focuses on natural resource extraction as it fits within the global economy. And the third section draws connections between settler colonialism, natural resource extraction, and the housing market. Finally, my talk ends with some suggestions for how to deal with the housing crisis in BC in light of the links that I draw in the first three sections. Overall, my talk tonight suggests that we cannot understand the current housing crisis in BC without understanding the role of settler colonialism and capitalism, both here right where we live and globally as well. So, to define settler colonialism, settler colonialism is a specific form of colonialism by which an imperial power takes over the land of other nations or politically and socially organized groups of people for the primary purpose of seizing the land. One of settler colonialism's logics is that it works to eliminate the original inhabitants of the land, who are indigenous peoples, by genocidal, cultural, political, and social means. Importantly, this logic of elimination of the native creates a settler sense of nativism or belonging. So the term nativism kind of means a sense of belonging. What I mean is that settler colonialism works in part by encouraging immigrants to this seized land to view themselves as the original and therein the native occupants of this land. The development of settler colonialism over centuries results in many things, but significant to my talk tonight is the result of settler occupants believing they have a right to own land, to own houses, and to otherwise occupy land that is not rightfully theirs. I feel like we are in a moment in which settler colonialism is talked about primarily in its cultural and political effects on Indigenous peoples. As Indigenous peoples, we deal with the presence of occupying states constantly. We deal with the denial of our political forms of membership and organization by having to assert our membership in our respective nations through the use of status cards, if we are so lucky to retain status in the eyes of the colonial state. Many of us don't. We deal with the denial of our cultural forms of membership and organization and the legacy of making cultural practices and political organization illegal through acts like the potlatch ban that affected potlatch cultures like the Nutchalnut, among others, in the beginning and middle of the 20th century. And many of our relatives dealt with the cultural genocide perpetrated through residential schools in Canada or Indian boarding schools, as they were called in the U.S. The cultural and political denials of our indigeneity have significant and long-lasting effects on us as Indigenous peoples. This I cannot deny. However, the Canadian state has recently taken a slight turn in its official policy towards Indigenous peoples in Canada, towards cultural recognition, largely prompted through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The TRC process has resulted in a significant amount of funding being injected into organizations that work to revitalize Indigenous cultural practices, art, and language. It has also resulted in increased funding and new funding initiatives for Indigenous people to access higher education. What the TRC process has not resulted in is addressing the root of settler colonialism's drive, and that is the ongoing occupation and the ongoing seizure of Indigenous land. While cultural and linguistic revitalization are politically transformative aspects of continuing to grow strong Indigenous nations, we cannot accept cultural revitalization, especially as it is supported by the colonial state, as a sufficient response by the state to its active role in continuing the colonial occupation of Indigenous lands. What this shift towards cultural and linguistic revitalization has the potential to mask is the ongoing process of accumulation by dispossession that the Canadian state and multinational corporations drive. Accumulation by dispossession is a term that means the seizure or stealing of land from Indigenous peoples in order to pull that land into the global economy. Accumulation by dispossession steals land in order to extract value from it to increase capitalist profits. Settler colonialism's main goal is to occupy land and extract value from it. In this sense, the main goal of settler colonialism is to enforce the ongoing process of accumulation by dispossession. Settler colonialism serves capitalism, and it exists because we live in a capitalist system. So, what role does the seizure of Indigenous land take today, and what is the relevance of this to a conversation about foreign investment in housing in BC? The main form that the stealing of Indigenous land takes today is through natural resource extraction. Canada's economy significantly relies on natural resource extraction, with natural resource extraction accounting for 17% of the gross domestic product in 2015. Resource extraction included 1.77 million jobs last year, and natural resource extraction companies' investments in the Canadian economic sectors totaled more than 40% of all investment in all economic sectors, amounting to $107 billion. Natural Resources Canada also reports that there are more than 400 major resource extraction projects under construction or planned for construction in the next 10 years, and these projects are worth $691 billion. Foreign direct investment in the resource extraction and energy sectors of the Canadian economy are also massive. According to Statistics Canada, foreign direct investment in the Canadian economy totaled more than $732 billion in 2014. Of that $732 billion, investment in resource extraction and energy sectors comes to more than 20%. Of all countries that supply foreign direct investment to Canada, the U.S. is by far the top investor, with 49% of all foreign direct investments coming from the States. In contrast, China supplied only 3.4% of total foreign direct investment in 2014. Canada also uses foreign direct investment in other countries as a way to generate capital and money. In 2015, Canada invested more than $1 trillion in the form of foreign direct investment. The U.S. received nearly 45% of this investment, making it by far the largest receiver of Canadian foreign direct investment. The majority of this foreign direct investment flowing out of Canada is put into three economic sectors of finance and insurance, management of companies, and manufacturing. Given these numbers, we can begin to understand Canada's role in the global economy. The global economy works across nation-state borders, and many nation-states today do not regulate flows of money in order to keep them within nation-states, or they regulate these flows very weakly. Given the fact that 20% of foreign direct investment coming into Canada is invested in resource extraction and energy sectors, we can also see that other countries have a direct hand in the dispossession of indigenous peoples from their lands. In this context, colonialism overruns national borders and is not solely driven by the Canadian state. In this context, we can understand that colonialism is a part of the global economy, and the global economy relies on colonialism in order to produce more profits and continue accessing natural resources. The ongoing colonization of indigenous lands in Canada is a requirement of the global economy in its current form. Now that we have established that settler colonialism in Canada is a part of the global economy and not just a unique feature of Canadian state power, we can ask, what does this have to do with the housing market? The biggest claim that this forum tonight is working on addressing is the claim that foreign direct investment is the cause for the current housing crisis, particularly in the cities of Vancouver and Toronto. There are two ways I want to respond to this. My first response is to place foreign direct investment in the resource and extraction and energy sectors in Canada alongside foreign direct investment in the housing market. Criticisms of foreign investment in natural resource extraction tend to suggest that if local companies were in charge, they would treat the environment better. But what is lost in this criticism, coming mostly from the environmental movement, is the understanding that resource extraction is a form of colonialism and directly impacts the lives of indigenous peoples who are dispossessed from their lands due to resource extraction projects, no matter who the investor is, no matter if the investor is a Canadian company or a foreign company. And the reason I don't think there's much complaint overall about the role of foreign investment in resource extraction beyond the environmental movement is that Canadians believe that the land that Canada is on today belongs to them, and that they have the right to develop this land and welcome investment in its development, regardless of the indigenous nations who continue to live on this land. The second way I want to respond to the claim that foreign direct investment is the leading cause of the housing crisis in Vancouver is to bring forward what statistics we do have available about foreign investment in the housing market. According to Statistics Canada, foreign direct investment in housing totaled just over $6 billion in 2014. With foreign direct investment in all industries totaling a little more than $732 billion, the amount of foreign direct investment in the housing market comes to just under 1% of all foreign direct investment. Now, I've read some commentators call into question the statistics that are provided by the Canadian government regarding foreign investment in the housing market. So let's assume that Statistics Canada is grossly underreporting the amount of foreign direct investment in the housing market. Let's assume that rather than $6 billion in 2014, it was actually double that, $12 billion. It would still only account for just under 2% of all foreign direct investment coming into Canada. Further, a recent report showed that 10% of house sales in Metro Vancouver were bought by foreign buyers in a roughly month-long period. Yet, what this report does not do is place these statistics in the context of other international cities. For example, Los Angeles and New York consistently see more than 10% of their housing market taken up by foreign investment, and yet these cities do not claim that their housing shortages are due to foreigners buying up housing stock. The claim that foreign investment is the cause for the housing crisis in Vancouver is a specific argument born from a legacy of anti-Asian racism in Vancouver. Keeping in mind the statistics mentioned earlier about the central role of the U.S. in the Canadian market, we can begin to see that the argument about foreign investment is deeply racialized. Finally, what does the foreign investment myth in the housing market have to do with the ongoing colonization of Indigenous peoples in Canada? Settler colonialism encourages immigrant populations, especially white immigrants, to believe that they are originary occupants of the land that Canada is on. Settler colonialism encourages the belief that this land can be owned by settlers, and that all settlers, but especially those who can be included within dominant white society, have the right to own a piece of land and a house. The foreign investment myth expresses upset and outrage that white settlers feel when their belief in the right to own land and a house is called into question. It is becoming increasingly hard for middle-class white settlers to buy into the housing market, in other words, to realize and experience their personal bounty made possible by settler colonialism. Their outrage at racialized foreigners is an expression of their settler entitlement to indigenous lands. In conclusion, what solution to the housing crisis does my talk suggest, given the points I have brought up about settler colonialism, resource extraction, and the global economy? I fear that I will receive only laughs at the solutions I can offer to the housing crisis because they will seem impractical. And yet, it's my belief that settler colonialism must be overturned in order to realize a just society in this land we call Canada. In order to address the roots of the housing crisis, we must address the founding dispossession of Indigenous peoples from their lands and their homes. This would require Canada to redraw its borders and to establish true nation-to-nation relationships with Indigenous nations who are occupied by Canada. In order to address the roots of the housing crisis, we must recognize how deeply capitalism relies on colonialism, that these two forces are violently intertwined. In order to truly address the housing crisis, we must smash the twin forces of capitalism and colonialism, and this means a hard, lifelong commitment to working in incremental ways in our communities. Thank you.
The most powerful motivational speeches that I have ever heard came from people who told me I couldn't do something. You know why? Because when they told me I couldn't do it, I was bound and determined to show them that I could.
All Access Pass is back for season 2. We are a collectively run weekly program that discusses equity, inclusion, and accessibility issues on and off UBC's campus, including both visible and invisible disabilities. Anyone can get involved. No experience is necessary. People of all abilities are welcome to join. Check us out on Facebook at All Access Pass or get involved by emailing accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
On Saturday, December 10th, communities around the world recognized the culmination of 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. This begins with the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women on November 25th and ends with Human Rights Day, which takes place today. From 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., CITR is broadcasting a selection of content that speaks to gendered violence, other forms of social violence, and possible modes of resistance. You can listen to these selections online by finding them under our special broadcast page at citr.ca/radio/special-broadcast.
I'd like to thank Chinatown Action Group for all their support and feedback and encouragement, and a shout out of gratitude to Janie and Yuli. She's over there. They listened to me and Steph the past two nights in a row practice our little speech, and this is their third time listening to it. So thank you very much for sharing your wisdom and experience and your honest advice. And also thank you to the Alliance for asking us to do this with them, and for the public statement that y'all released against the foreign investment myth. And to start, we're talking about anti-Asian racism because it's very obvious, and especially in the recent, I guess, heightened and overt form that it's taking in light of Trump and how the housing crisis is formed. And to connect it with Chinatown, where I work with a lot of seniors, the foreign investment myth, just like the model minority myth, may seem like it's not that harmful or perhaps even positive, but they're both profoundly and very negative, and it really affects Chinese residents in the Chinatown neighborhood. And just some context for what's happening in Chinatown, there's been unprecedented development and displacement, especially of low-income communities, and many shops serving the low-income Chinese community are also closing down. And I'm sure if anyone goes to Chinatown, they can see really drastic changes. And so last week, the Chinatown Concern Group members, they spoke up against discriminatory policies and the undemocratic processes that the city has. So most of our members are working class and female Chinese seniors who only speak Chinese. And specifically, they addressed two open houses that were held last month regarding the Chinatown Economic Revitalization Action Plan. Such a mouthful. And like a lot of open houses and consultations that the city of Vancouver does, there is very inadequate translation and interpretation. They use very vague and exclusive urban planning terms and vocabulary that was also hard to understand. And there is also a tremendously low turnout. So only 80 people showed up to the two open houses that was meant for all of Chinatown. And this is because a lot of our members and a lot of people that we've spoken to have said that they didn't receive any notice about the open houses, so they really did want to attend, but they were purposely excluded. And so this is really concerning for us because the most vulnerable and at risk, they also have the biggest stake in Chinatown because it's their home, and it's a very like specific or culturally specific place that they need, and they've been purposely excluded from these conversations and from policymaking and urban planning. And there haven't been, so the city has heard a lot of opposition to the Historic Area Heights Review, which was passed in 2011 and attracted a lot of developers to the area because they took off a lot of height restrictions from the buildings. And so although the city has heard a lot of dissenting voices, they haven't really addressed it in the new policy review. And there's only going to be 20% affordable housing, and they said affordable, which is not always, sometimes that could be $800 a month or more. Yeah, and they said it will not be at pension or a welfare rate. And I guess this press conference really just centered marginalized voices and sort of put a new narrative in mainstream media and emphasized the way in which vulnerable communities have not been a part of the policy process, and brings up the question of how consultations are structured when not even those who are most affected are included. So like government policies, the foreign investment myth is also rooted in racism, and racism plays out in very real and violent ways against low-income Chinese seniors in the neighborhood. So many non-Chinese residents, through perhaps media or through internalized racism, they hold prejudices and very harmful and based assumptions about Chinese people. And a lot of Chinese people are assaulted in food lineups and are robbed, and they feel very unsafe in their own homes and neighborhoods. And this is very unfortunate that racism divides poor people and not just the Chinese community. And so poor people are disproportionately affected by racism. And this sort of anti-Chinese racism and how Asians are foreignized, it isn't anything new, and it also isn't something that's ended. So a lot of people think we are post-racial. That is not true. like I was saying earlier, government-sanctioned racist policies, such as the head tax and the Exclusion Act, and even policies in Chinatown today that encourage development, market development specifically, and gentrification. So gentrification is often seen as natural or progress, or something that needs to happen to like clean up a city or to better society. But really, gentrification is displacement, and it's putting people's lives at risk, and it has a huge impact on their mental and physical health. And so I agree that development is very important and improving society, but it can't be at the expense of poor people, or else it really isn't, society really isn't improving for everyone. And also, we were really concerned group was really concerned about the co-optation of language that the city always uses. So, for example, the words consultation or open house or revitalization, these should all be words with positive connotations, but they've twisted these words and used them really as covers for their displacement policies. And so when people hear these words now, they're really scared and confused. And revitalization is also not true, because Chinatown is not dead. And in Chinatown, the real threat that we see, or the housing crisis, is really not because of foreign investment, but because of local developers. And this includes West Bank Corporations, BD Living, Bosa Properties, and the Prospero Group. And these BC-based developers are the real people who are the real ones who are contributing to the housing crisis and increasing property prices. And so now we see the new manifestation of racism, particularly anti-Chinese or anti-Asian racism, is this foreign investment narrative, since it's only blamed on people of color, or mostly people of East Asian descent. And it makes sense, because capitalism is also founded in racism and displacement and taking advantage of the lower working classes. And it also makes sense that a lot of, I guess, white settlers seeing the influx in affluent people of color really fuels xenophobia and resentment, because capitalism was supposed to benefit them only. And so it's unfortunate that poor people are not as visible or powerful or paid as much attention to, and they also have to face the brunt of this new form of racism. And so in this sense, racism affects people of all classes, but it affects poor people the most. And in terms of displacement and gentrification as well, these affect poor people the most. And growing up as a person of color and being Chinese as well, somehow our communities believe that we can escape racism or prejudice by working hard and moving up social classes, which is sort of like, I guess, the American dream, and how we're all tricked into thinking that capitalism is democratic or fair, or that we all start from the same starting point. But I've seen that money doesn't change the color of your skin. And so I think, like Natalie said, it's important that we continue fighting colonialism and gentrification as well, because fighting gentrification is also fighting racism, especially in the context of Chinatown. And just like colonialism, gentrification is justified with progress or development, and is completely untrue.
Yeah, so thanks, Beverly, for starting the presentation off with a really good framing of anti-Asian racism in Vancouver and really looking at how this has really developed through the Chinatown Concern Group's press conference that happened recently and the ways in which racism and gentrification in Chinatown are really affecting the Chinese seniors that you work with. So I just want to acknowledge that the land we are on are unceded Coast Salish territories. So the indigenous communities who have lived on these lands before settlers arrived were actually the first to be displaced in Canada. So really, the housing crisis has already happened for them. It's not new, and the issue right now is just that it's impacting everyone else. So foreign investment has happened in the past in other parts of the world, which we can really trace back to imperial conquests by the Europeans and later the North Americans. And it continues to happen today and not just in Vancouver. It's happening in cities in Asia, such as Hong Kong, Singapore, Beijing, and Shanghai. And these cities are going through the global housing crisis, and they're also addressing it in different ways. Okay, sorry. So they're also addressing the housing crisis in different ways. And so globalization has been happening for a while, but it's not just in Vancouver, it's happening everywhere else. So with that said, the main question I'm interested in tonight is how do race, capitalism, and settler colonialism inform each other in the context of Vancouver's current housing crisis and foreign investment debate? So the first part I want to talk more about is the history of anti-Chinese racism in Vancouver within a settler colonial context. As Beverly sort of touched upon, anti-Asian racism in Vancouver's history, Chinese migrants in Vancouver have long been subjected to racism. There have been the race riots of 1907, the head tax of 1885, the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1923. So I just want to, what's interesting to me is how all these histories have influenced present narratives of Chinese people as associated with money and with capitalism. We can see how racism has been used as a tool by white settlers to really divide and reinforce this position of Asian migrants as laborers and Asians as part of this settler colonial project and really displacing and colonizing indigenous peoples. So I look to Eco Day, who states and argues that Asians have been racialized through capitalist settler colonial projects. And I think it's important to recognize this because we can sort of understand how these colonial histories have shaped present-day racist views of Asians as really connected to more of this destructive form of capitalism and really influenced all these narratives that we hear today as these wealthy Chinese immigrants who are taking over the housing market. So these narratives have antagonized Asians and caused divisions within and across marginalized communities. Not only that, but the association of Asians with negative capitalism has allowed white settlers to gloss over and erase their complicity with capitalist exploitation from collective memory and history. And the narrative of the foreign investment myth, to echo Beverly's point, is indeed rooted in racism and colonialism. Foreign buyer influence has shaped the current housing crisis, but foreign investment is just one of many reasons. Moreover, data indicates that foreign investment from China is small. Actually, the majority of foreign investors in BC are Europeans and Americans, who account for 70% combined, and only Asians are 22% of them are Asian investors. And this is from the BC Assessment Authority, the 2010 property statistics. So talking after the foreign investment debate and how anti-Asian racism is connected to all this, I want to look more at the bigger picture and kind of say, so what can be done? Like how is the struggle for Chinatown a collective struggle for all who are facing displacement? So here I want to reflect on two ways in which we can start to address these issues and expand housing security. First, I really appreciate Natalie's point in saying that we have to dismantle settler colonial structures. And I think it's really important to understand that decolonization is implicated across all communities, and that if we are going to strategize and talk about how to solve the housing crisis, we have to really strategize alongside indigenous communities and their struggles for sovereignty and self-determination. Secondly, I think more inter and intra-community dialogues need to happen that involve the most vulnerable. So as Beverly said, open houses aren't enough, and I think they're imperfect vehicles for housing justice. So by inter-community, this means that we must recognize that the Chinese community in Chinatown is not homogenous. There are diverse players, leaders, and groups within this community with different class interests and views on what Chinatown should look like. Inter-community conversations across generations that involve low-income, working-class seniors' voices especially is crucial. In other words, the Chinatown Action Group is interested in working with those in the Chinese community who are invested in fighting for those who are the most marginalized and oppressed. And by intra, I mean that conversations need to happen across communities. The issue of gentrification and displacement happening in Chinatown and the downtown east side are connected to what's happening in all these different neighborhoods across Metro Vancouver. For instance, in Burnaby, in the Metrotown neighborhood, and around the Joy Station in Renfrew-Collingwood neighborhood. In these conversations that we're having, we need to address the root causes of poverty, displacement, and gentrification. And I think more than anything else, we need to have a shared analysis of the structural powers and processes of settler colonialism, imperialism, and global capitalism at work. Ultimately, I really think what needs to happen is that we have to organize for social justice to really address the structural issues in society. It's about building a community that wants to get to the root of social problems, and it's about having conversations with people on the ground and trying to move them to act on the side of justice. So if we want to talk about concrete actions, that could be talking to people in CG, participating in discussion groups. We should listen to the Chinese seniors, build relationships with them, or speaking out about displacement in your own communities. What we need to focus on is building stronger cross-community alliances across the city and a deeper collective analysis of what's happening in order to take shared action for housing justice and ensure that everyone has access to safe and affordable housing. Thanks.
Hi, good evening. I'm Hesed, and I'm a community organizer for Migrante BC. I am a migrant worker, and I hope to articulate the perspective of a migrant worker when it comes to the housing crisis. So after earning my license to practice nursing in the Philippines, I was unable to find a job. Several weeks of job hunting turned to several months, which then turned to several years of being unsuccessful in securing a job to gain clinical nursing experience. While waiting to hear back from the hospitals I applied at, I worked several odd jobs, including teaching English to Korean children, answering phone calls for an American telecom giant, and selling homes and condominiums as a real estate consultant working under a licensed broker. It is in selling properties that I learned that those who have multiple houses and properties were the only ones interested in purchasing more property, while those who need housing cannot afford to. I also learned that both developers and home buyers in the Philippines were mostly made up of wealthy foreign investors. But let's get back to that later. I would like to talk about the migrant struggle. So after 6 years of not being able to find a job that is suitable for my nursing skill, the more obvious migration became to me. That is when I began to study my options into immigrating here and learned that I really didn't have any option except to come in under a low-skilled immigration stream, and that is the Live-In Caregiver Program, which is now under the Temporary Worker Program. The Temporary Foreign Worker Program is a federal program that facilitates the entry of migrant workers into Canada to address the country's short-term and regional labor and skill demand. By TFW, we mean the broad program with three distinct streams under it: the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program, the Live-In Caregiver Program, now called In-Home Caregivers Program, and the pilot project for occupations requiring lower levels of formal training, oftentimes referred to as low-skilled programs. For the latter, these include servers in the restaurant sector, and unlike the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program, are not limited to Canadian farms, but include staffing of greenhouses and hothouses. The housing issues faced by migrant workers in the Temporary Foreign Worker Program must be seen through a human rights lens. Gaps in access to appropriate and affordable housing must be identified and strategies discussed and collectively worked on to address migrant workers' housing issues. What is the human rights framework for housing? We believe that this framework rests on the points that migrants' rights are human rights, that migrant workers are seen as human individuals with dignity. We must believe that there are standards in housing that must be met, and when these standards are violated, that there must be mechanisms to resolve these. The Temporary Foreign Workers Program is in opposition to these rights. The Live-In Caregiver Program once forced caregivers to give up their human rights by requiring them to live with their employers, a situation that makes the caregivers vulnerable to exploitation from their employers, who have access to them 24 hours a day, 5 to 7 days a week. In 2014, the caregiver program was drastically reformed, taking away the live-in requirements and making it an option instead. However, with the housing crisis worsening each year, and with wages not increasing to meet our living needs, caregivers are still economically tied and dependent on their employers. In order to cope with the cost of living here, caregivers still opt to live with their employers despite forced overtime and wage theft. On top of that, caregivers are now tormented by the four-in and four-out rule, which grants migrant workers only 4 years of allowable work and must automatically leave Canada and stay out of Canada for another 4 years before reapplying for the same immigration stream. With this restriction, caregivers are pressed for time and are rendered unable to leave abusive employers just so they could get their hours into their requirements for permanent residency applications. The lack of privacy and mobility that results from this setup is a fundamental part of the violation of human rights. Caregivers under the previous program still pay for their housing and food, and these are deducted from their wages. And wages, minimum wage, that is around $1,200 per month. On their days off or vacation days, we do know that caregivers rely on friends so they can stay somewhere for the weekend, or they pay for weekend accommodations because they would rather spend their days off outside of their employers' homes where they are on their employer's beck and call. Workers participating in the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program are subjected to notoriously deplorable housing conditions, among other violations. Because there are housing construction limitations on some agricultural lands, housing that is put up must be temporary, so it is likely to be substandard. The types of housing documented by migrant groups like the Association of Agricultural Workers include trailers, new and converted housing on a farm property, motels, and apartments that have problems with sanitation, drinking water, overcrowding, heat, and etc. We have heard testimonies from our migrante counterparts in Ontario in their field visits regarding the accommodation of Filipino TFWs in the farms. What have they heard echo the housing conditions of the Spanish-speaking farm workers? There have been many reports of inappropriate and overpriced accommodations. Many migrant workers are paid lower wages than permanent residents or citizens, and their work permits tie them to their employers, making them dependent on their employers for their status, housing, access to health care, and access to basic information about their rights. We have heard from the TFWs that they are sometimes obliged to stay at places owned by their recruiters. They are able to leave when they know of other cheaper lodgings for rents. We know that TFWs will opt for cheaper accommodations and divide rent among themselves, a situation that may not be acceptable to other Canadians. Furthermore, we are aware of barriers TFWs face in taking action to protect and improve their rights. Migrant workers fear that employers will take retaliatory action in the form of harassment, arbitrary terminations like what happened to me, against workers that they consider to be troublemakers. It is for this reason that many workers silently endure what they consider shameful and degrading living conditions. There is also the thinking that they must endure, make sacrifices so that money can continue to be sent home to waiting families and children. So is it really true that migrant workers are leeching from the system? So Canada is bringing in more and more workers on temporary work permits rather than as permanent residents. Temporary migration as opposed to permanent migration means that Canada is bringing in more and more workers, but only on a temporary basis, with fewer rights and with fewer services. They often lack adequate access to health services and information about medical and community services they are entitled to, as well as important information on their legal rights. Migrant workers pay taxes and pay into social benefits that they will never be able to claim. So tonight, I plead to everyone to come to an understanding that the housing crisis is truly a global phenomenon. A greedy corporation will always accept money, whether it is from here or abroad. It puts profit over people and capitalizes on our hardship and struggles as oppressed and marginalized people. The terms foreign investment or foreigners only seek to divide our community, to weaken us, and undermine our capacity to demand for what is owed to us. Let us resist the forces that divide us. We will see housing justice when the government cuts the military budget, the prison and detention budget, and police and immigration enforcement budget, and use these money on non-market housing that is affordable, secure, and safe. Housing justice becomes possible when the government stops subsidizing Canadian mining companies who plunder and commit human rights violations in other countries. There is money in housing. It should be put in housing, not anywhere else. We believe that housing justice will not happen with increasing housing rents, no living wages, no increase in social assistance and housing subsidies, especially for our poor community members and people with disabilities. Displacement and housing justice do not go together, and here in Vancouver, we are witness to worsening homelessness. In our very own community, decent housing is well beyond the reach of our Filipino working class and migrant community. The social costs of housing injustice are huge. Without appropriate housing, integration, employment, recovery from mental illness or disabilities, escaping violence, and so on, are often not possible. We see this with our newly arrived Filipino families who are trying to settle in the city and rebuild their lives after being separated under the Live-In Caregiver Program. Many live in shared homes, crowded basements, and many are forced to move out of the city when housing becomes unaffordable. working multiple jobs to be able to pay rent is an everyday reality. We believe that housing is a human right. And when housing is denied or kept well beyond the reach of people so they can live decent lives, then that is a violation of human right. We stand in solidarity with our fellow working class and poor communities to demand the Canadian government make housing that is affordable, secure, and safe for all a priority.